The Parsha of Baal Osecha opens with the third appearance of the menorah, as we mentioned on a number of occasions. We have in Chumash Amos, in Chumash Bayikra, and once again in Chumash Bamidbar. Baal Osecha is Aneiros. And the lighting of the menorah is directed very explicitly towards Aaron. Daber el Aaron. Speak to Aaron. Hashem says to Moshe, speak to Aaron and tell him about lighting the menorah. Rashi has a well-known comment here. The first Rashi of the Parsha always has mazel. And Rashi discusses the idea of smichus parshios, which he does every once in a while for Rashi reasons. If two sections of the Torah are juxtaposed, and Parshas Noso has many different things as they move from one to the other, Nazir and Sota and Duchening and Nasiim, and Rashi last week comments on a number of them, not all of them. And this brings us to the menorah, and it comes straight after the Parsha of the Nasiim, the 12 inaugural days of the Mishkan. Rashi asks, Lama nismecha Parshas ha-menorah le-Parshas ha-Nasiim? Why does the Torah put the section of menorah next to, immediately following the Parsha of the Nasiim? Lefisha kesherah Aaron chanukas ha-Nasiim, when Aaron saw the inauguration, the dedication of the Nasiim on those 12 days, each one is offering his korban. Chol sha'oz dato, he became despondent. Shelohayo imahem b'chanukah, he wasn't with them. Lehu v'lo shivto, not him, not his tribe. Levi was not represented, Levi did not feature within those 12 inaugural days. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Aaron, Chayecha, by your life, Shelcha gedola mishelahem, yours is greater than theirs. Shata madlik umetiv es haneiros, you will kindle and you will prepare the lights. And there are many, many discussions that take place based off of this Rashi. Interestingly, just a parenthetical comment, which Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitt says, if the problem was that Shevet Levi was not represented in the Chanukah, and the consolation comes to Aaron, we must conclude that consolation was effective for all of the tribe of Levi. Otherwise, you still have most of Levi who feels hard done by. Because Levi wasn't involved, and Aaron gets to light the menorah, but what about the rest of us? And we see the cohesion, and as the early parshas of Bamidbar, they're about the Kohanim, shall we say, in the epicenter, but around them are the Levim, and there's cohesion and there's harmony there, to the extent that if Aaron gets something, all of Levi feels better. That's a nice thing to aspire to. But at any rate, Mefarshim raise a simple question. Why is Aaron despondent? He wasn't involved in the Chanukas HaMishkan in those first 12 days. Let's ask a simple shaila. Why not? Now we may say, well, he wasn't invited, he wasn't commanded. But where does the problem begin? No one was invited. All of these first 12 days were the product of the initiative of the Nasiim. They were the ones that brought Karbonos. It was entirely voluntary. So Aaron now, his position needs to be pondered just a little bit more. He's despondent that he's not involved. So get involved. No one else waited for an invitation. If you want to bring a korban, bring a korban. So if he wants to be involved, so let him also bring a korban. Why is he on the side feeling despondent, where all you need to do is to do something? And this question is raised by one of the very special Perushim on Rashi's commentary, the Perush Or Yashar, Rav Binyamin Ze'ev Hartman. And he gives a very subtle and elegant answer to this question. As we know, Parshas Noso has a reputation. It puts fear into every bar mitzvah boy, because it's the longest Parsha in the Torah. Half of Parshas Noso is taken up with the Korbanos of the Nasiim. That's most of chapter 7. It's 89 psukim long. And the reason why is, as you cannot fail to have noticed, is that each and every korban is repeated. Everyone gets their six psukim, and that's 6 times 12, and then you have the introduction and then the lead out. And it's one of those parshas where the Torah just keeps going, and it gives you the details of each and every korban for each nasi. And the question, of course, is why? There's many mitzvahs that we learn, or many halachas that we learn from an extra letter, or less. And here you have this, the Torah spares no ink when it comes to the Nesiim. Why is that so? Why did the Torah not just say, give us the Korban for the first one, and say, and so too did all of the other 11, and you could condense the Parsha by dozens of Sukkim. But if you look in the Midrash Rabbah, we will see something quite amazing. For the Midrash gives us the symbolism behind the Korbanos of each of the 12 Nesiim. That is to say, although in form these korbanos were identical, korbano kares kesef achas shloshim meyam mishkalas, so on and so forth, parachad ben bakar, the items were identical for each of the 12, but the thought behind it and the intention behind it for each nasi was different, and the Midrash details it. It pertained and applied to each nasi as relates to his tribe. Yehuda, the korbanos meant the following, and the 130 for Zebulun means something else, and the 70 for Yisachar means something else. Effectively, the reason why the Torah repeats these 12 is because it is not 12 times 1. They are 12 separate sets of korbanos when you realize what went behind them. But what that means is, in order to qualify, so to speak, in order to be eligible to offer the korbanos, one can't just say, that's what everyone's bringing, so that's what I should bring also to be together with everyone else. The license to bring these korbanos on the part of each and every nasi was only if he was inspired to do so in terms of how these korbanos relate to his tribe. And he saw the associations and the allusions and the parallels. And every nasi had that, except for Aaron. And without that inspiration, without that pnimius, we could say, without that inner content that goes behind the korban, Aaron, although it's all voluntary, but Aaron is not volunteering. He's not prepared to bring a korban which is hollow, so to speak, bereft of any unique relationship with his tribe. And the associations were not forthcoming. And that is why Aaron, as much as all you needed to do was volunteer, all you needed to do was to step forward, but you need to have some inner content in the Korban to step forward. Aaron didn't feel that, and that's why he's not prepared, just because kachos in kulam. Those are the korbanos, I have those animals available, I'll bring them also. That's not acceptable for Aaron. But then he needed a consolation. Interestingly, one may say, If now the despondency of Aaron, shall we say, is lack of inner content with regards to how these korbanos might relate to his tribe, his consolation came in the form of lighting the menorah. And what's that got to do? How does that console Aaron? But as we know, one of the cosmic effects, one of the spiritual effects of lighting the menorah is the menorah represents Torah, kiner mitzvah, with Torah or, and the act of lighting the menorah had the effect of bringing down insight into Torah, further understanding, deeper appreciation, and more crystallized knowledge. And therefore, what was missing from Aaron was the sense of insight in his time, with regards to how these animals might relate to his tribe. The consolation came in the form of lighting the menorah, which now provides literally illumination and insight for all of the Jewish people in all matters of Torah. So that's a very interesting approach to this first Rashi. As important, I think we may say, as important for the questions that it raises in the Rashi as for the answers that it provides. Now, I'd like to move on and actually begin the next segment of the shiur this evening by referring to something in the Siddur. And this takes place at the time of Hagbah. Hagbah Satora, or Hagbah as we call it in English. And as we know, there is a certain nusach that people say when the Sefer Torah is lifted up. And the way to lift the Sefer Torah, or the way for to do Hagbah, as they say, is actually for the one who's doing Hagbah to turn to his right, because you always turn to the right. Even though there's a bit of an irony here. As they say, kol peniel shatapona lo yu ela liyamin. Whenever you turn, you should always turn to the right. So the one who does Hagbah should turn to the right. In so doing, the irony is that it's the people to his left that will see the Sefer Torah first. Because as he turns to the right, the people to his right only see the back of the Sefer Torah until he does a complete circuit. Some people, they show it to the right and to the left, but the people in front of them never see the Sefer Torah. Therefore, the ideal way is to do a complete Hakafah, but it starts by turning to the right. For Sfardim, who the Sefer Torah, when they open it, they show it. So actually, when they turn to the right, the people to their right see it first. For Ashkenazim, everything is backwards. And the writing is facing towards the one who lifts up, but nonetheless he turns to the right. But in any case, what does the Tzibur say? So as we know, they say, V'zos HaTorah Shasam Moshe Lefnei B'nei Yisrael Al-Pi Hashem B'yad Moshe. That is how it appears in all of the authorized prayer books, which means that this text is authorized. Interestingly, there is a custom that is recorded in the name of the Vilna Gaon. And in order to understand the background to this custom, we need to find the background to this text. Where do these words come from? V'zos HaTorah, etc. So it happens to be that most of this text, namely, V'zos HaTorah Asher Sam Moshe Lefnei B'nei Yisrael, is a pasuk in Parshas Vayeschanan, in Devarim Perek Dalet. So that, those words are a pasuk. So far, so good. What about the words Al Pi Hashem B'yad Moshe? Where are they from? If you look through all of Parshas Vayeschanan, you won't find them. So where do they derive from? Says the Vilna Gaon, they're from our Parsha, from Parshas Ba'al Osecha. If you take a look in Perek Tes, pasuk Kaf Tes. Pardon me, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Perek Tes, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. And Perek Tes describes the travels of Bnei Yisrael. When the cloud moved, they would move, and so on and so forth. Sometimes it would stay still for a while, sometimes for a short time. Pasuk Kaf Gimel, the final Pasuk of this Perek. Al Pi Hashem Yachanu. By the word of Hashem, they would encamp. Al Pi Hashem Yisau. And by the word of Hashem, they would travel. Es mishmeres Hashem shamar, they kept the guarding of Hashem. Al pi Hashem biyad Moshe. The words that we say during Hagbah, al pi Hashem biyad Moshe, are the final words of this pasuk. Bamidbar perek tes, pasuk kaf gimel. The question is, why do we say them? How do they get it into Hagbah? The opening words, v'zos HaTorah Shasam Moshe, that we understand. You see the Torah, you say v'zos HaTorah. But where does Al Pi Hashem B'yad Moshe come from? So the Gaon explains that we know already that whenever we take the Sefer Torah out and put it back, we also quote psukim that relate to the Aron traveling. And that's also from this Mishpasha, from the very end of Perek Yud. When we take the Sefer Torah out, we say Vayihi ben Soah Ha'aron. When we put the Sefer Torah back, we say, Uvunucho Yomar, Shuvo Hashem, Rivos Alfei Yisrael. Those two psukim are from Bamidbar, the final psukim of Perek Yud. Psukim Lamed Hei and Lamed Vav. Lamed Ad Lamed Hei. And they are, And they're famous because they're bracketed by nuns, of which we have spoken on other occasions. But we see that because the travel, so to speak, the movement of the Sefer Torah parallels the movement of the Aron, therefore, at that appropriate time, we mention the parallel pasuk, when it would travel and when it would come to rest. Okay, what's that got to do with Hagbah? Because Hagbah actually is a time where the Sefer Torah is in transit. That is to say, originally it was taken out and put on the bima. soon it will be put back in the Aron. But in the meanwhile, it's lifted from the Bima, and then the person who did Hagba sits with it. So that's like it's a sub journey. It's like it's moving within transit. And therefore, parallel to this interim travel of the Sefer Torah, we quote this pasuk, which again is about the way that they would travel with the Aron. Al pi Hashem, biyad Moshe. That's how those words, it's like a mini journey of the Sefer Torah, and therefore we quote that pasuk that relates yet to the journeys. So it turns out there are three psukim that we mention on Shema. Vayi ben Soa in the beginning, Uvunucha Yomar at the end, and Al pi Hashem biyad Moshe in the middle. However, says the Vilna Gaon, now that we realize where these words come from, it should change the way we recite them. Why? Because there is a principle when it comes to quoting psukim and reciting psukim of the Torah. Namely, we do not do things in halves. Or, as the Gemara phrases it in Maseches Megillah and in Maseches Tanis, kol psukah delo paske Moshe anan lo paskinan. Any pasuk, anywhere that Moshe didn't put a break for the end of a pasuk, we don't put a break. Not at the end, and not at the beginning. And that is why it is very important when we read psukim, and when we recite psukim, to have the whole pasuk. It's not acceptable to do less than the whole pasuk. That being the case, says the Vilna Gaon, the correct way to, or nusach, for the time of Hagba, is to start with Zos HaTorah Asher Sam Masheh Lefnei B'nei Yisrael, and then to say Al Pi Hashem Yachanu Al Pi Hashem Yisau Es Mishmer Hashem Shamaru Al Pi Hashem Biyad Moshe. The whole pasuk, not just the second half. Very interesting. I actually checked a number of hours ago with Rav Dav Eliach, who is something of an authority on the Divrei Torah, the Vilna Gaon, has done a tremendous amount of research. I called him up and I asked, does anyone do this? Firstly, is it an authentic minhag of the Vilna Gaon? Many things are ascribed, and he's checked all these things out. He said, yes, most people don't do it, some people do. Descendants of the Vilna Gaon will do this for sure. But the question is, what about the rest of us? After the Gaon has put his position forward, it is not appropriate just to say the tail end of a pasuk. Why is it that we do exactly that? And apparently, the justification or the explanation of the way most people do it, just to say those words, Al pi Hashem biyad Moshe, not to be concerned that it's not an entire pasuk, is based on a statement of the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham states that the whole idea that one doesn't say half a pasuk, not the first half, not the second half, that's when one is reading the psukim as per reading. However, if the pasuk is incorporated as part of tefillah, and tefillah can use psukim, it can also use parts of psukim. There's no longer an insistence that you say the whole pasuk. And the thinking behind this qualification, what difference does it make? Are you reading? Are you davening? What difference does it make? Seemingly the understanding is that the problem with reading part of a pasuk, just a half, for example, is that it seems as if the person wishes to assert that this is how the pasuk should be read or broken up. That as almost like to establish or assert a new division within the pasuk. That is not acceptable. But that's only applicable when you're reading, as reading, when you're part of Kriyas HaTorah, so you've got to read it the way the psukim are. But if within davening, we quote halves of psukim, pieces of psukim, often, just to give one example, perhaps we don't even realize it, but as soon as we note it, of course we will. In Kedusha of Musaf on Shabbos, so we write to Elokeinu, Hu Avinu, and then we say Vuhu Yashmienu Baracham Avshenis Benekochai, and he should tell us in front of all Benekochai Lios Lachem Elokim Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Those words, Lios Lachem Lelokim, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, are the end of the final pasuk of Shema. But we don't start from the beginning. We don't say, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Hotzei Yeschem Eretz Mitzrayim, Lios Lelokim, etc. We just quote the final clause of the pasuk, And that's entirely acceptable because we're not reading the Torah now. We're davening. And as part of tefillah, it's possible to, and acceptable to have pieces, or sections of psukim. So thus far, we have a distinction between reading as reading, where it's got to be the whole pasuk, and reading as davening. Psukim as davening, where we can quote selectively, shall we say. Interestingly, to further broaden the discussion, there is a discussion in the middle. Namely, what if we're performing mitzvahs? Sometimes psukim are enlisted in the performance of mitzvahs. Does one need to be particular there to recite psukim in totem, right, the entire pasuk? Certainly the minhag is not to. And two classic examples, one from Friday night. How does Kiddush begin? There's, I would think, two main... either Yom HaShishi by Yechud HaShamayim. For some people, it's in brackets, and you never know what to do with brackets. Depends how hungry people are. But there's four other words. You can start by Yeru Vayivoka, Yom HaShishi, and that basically are the two mainstream openings for Kiddush. What's very interesting about both of them, neither of them are an entire pasuk. They are both the tail end of a pasuk, because the pasuk actually begins, and this is the end of Bereshis Perek Aleph, Vayar Elokim es kol asher asa v'hine tov me'od vayere vayivoke yom hashishi. And yet you find Jews throughout the world and elsewhere who, when they make Kiddush, they either start Vayar Vayivoker or Yom HaShishi. It's part of a pasuk. It's truncated. Why is that acceptable? And the answer is because, once again, it's not in fulfillment of, we're using psukim, but not to fulfill the mitzvah of reading from the Torah or Talmud Torah. It's the mitzvah of Kiddush. And within the context of a different mitzvah called Kiddush, one can use part of a pasuk. Another example, and this is pointed out by Shlomo Zalman Orbach. In the end of Shachris, there are the six zechiros, the six things that one should remember every day, six remembrances. And one of them, very apropos, just after Shavuos, remembering Har Sinai. And how does it begin? Raki shamer locha, ushmor nafshecha ma'od, pentishkach es advarim, be careful, remember, tell them to your children, etc. And what should you tell them? What's the final words of the zikaron? Yom asher amadata lifnei Hashem elokecha b'chorev. The day that you stood before Hashem in Chorev. And that is the end of that zikaron, of that remembrance, with the end of Shachris. But if you look in the Chumash, you will see that is not the end of the pasuk. That is the beginning of the pasuk. Yom asher amadata lifnei Hashem elokecha b'chorev. But the pasuk continues, be'emor Hashem elai, etc., so on and so forth, says of Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So we start a pasuk, but we don't finish it. How is that acceptable? But once again, the answer is because it's not in fulfillment of learning Torah, reading Torah. It's in fulfillment of the mitzvah of remembering Har Sinai, for whose purpose we use psukim. But if it's enlisted for another mitzvah, it can be also part of a pasuk. And presumably, to come back to the minhag ha'olam, the widespread custom with regards to Hagbah, is that it's also taken to be part of the Seder HaTfilah more, not so much reading Psukim per se, and therefore there is no objection to just taking that segment of the Pasuk, Al Pi Hashem, Biyad Moshe, and just attaching it to the end. But it is very interesting to know, regardless of whether you say the whole Pasuk, to know where it comes from and what it is doing, what those words are doing within the context of Hagbah. So you never know when a pasuk in the Torah will somehow lead you back to the Siddur. And the more appreciation, of course, that we get into the tefillah in all of its facets, the better we are. So coming back to the parsha, let's have a look at the end of Perek Yud, and we will see there's a very interesting. It becomes a Rashi issue, as we'll see. The end of Perek Yud, pasuk Kaftes. Vayomer Moshe, Perek Yud Pasuk Kaftes. Vayomer Moshe lechovav ben Reuel hamidyoni chosen Moshe. Moshe says to his father-in-law, if we would translate this, we say he said to Yisro. If you look at the pasuk, every name is used for him except for Yisro. He's Chovev, son of Reuel, father-in-law of Moshe. And Moshe says, "No, Samanachnu." He's encouraging him. We're all going now. Elamokam Asher Amar Hashem, to the place that Hashem said, "Oso etein lachem," that He will give it to us. Lecho itanu, come with us. Beit Avdelach, we'll be good to you. Ki Hashem diber tov al Yisrael. So this is the pasuk where Moshe is encouraging Yisrael to come with them. We won't go into the details of the ensuing one or two psukim. Yisrael initially demurs and is reluctant, but Moshe further encourages him, and seemingly in the end Yisro stayed with them. But the words that I would like to focus on are the words in Pasuk Kavtes, Nosi'im Anachnu. We are traveling to Eretz Yisrael. Now, if it's Moshe talking, and he's talking in the first person plural, and says we are traveling, that means that as far as he's concerned, he also is traveling to Eretz Canaan. Okay, Rashi notes it. Why does Moshe attach himself to everyone else who's going to the land? Because the decree barring him from entering the land had not yet been enacted. He thought that he was going in. I mean, everyone thought they were going in. In the end, none of them almost went in. But at this time, it's before Meraglim, and for Moshe Rabbeinu, it's before the main Meriva, it's before the whole episode with the rock. He doesn't know that's going to happen, and therefore, as far as he's concerned, we're all entering. Nosim Anachnu. Now, interestingly, this comment of Rashi seems to be quite straightforward, perhaps so straightforward that maybe even redundant, in the sense that clearly Moshe thinks that he's traveling with them. Why on earth should he think he's not traveling with them? After all, as we just said, the episode with the rock is years away and hasn't yet happened. But what's interesting is the matter is far from simple, specifically within Rashi, because there are at least two places where Rashi has already indicated that Moshe is aware or has been made aware that he will not be entering Eretz Canaan. And they are as far back as Parshas Shemos. And we'll see them in reverse order for reasons that will be apparent. The very end of Parshas Shemos. Moshe's had his first mission to Paro. It's gone very badly, and Moshe comes back pained at how more difficult things have become for the Jewish people, and complains. Nothing's happened. Things have only gone backwards. Things have become harder for the Jewish people. Why is it happening this way? He feels the pain of the Jewish people and complains on their behalf. The final pasuk of Shemos, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Hashem says to Moshe, Atatire. Now you'll see. Asher e'eseh lefaro. Now you'll see what will happen to Paro. Okay, there's much discussion there. How does that answer Moshe's question? But Rashi focuses on the words atatira. Now you will see. Says Rashi, hirharta al midosai. You impugned the way that I act. You with insufficient understanding, you complained and etc. Loka Avram, not like Avram. Look what happened to Avram. I told Avram ki Yitzchak kikar lechazara. I told him that Yitzchak would be the continuation of his line. V'chaka chamarti lo haleu leola. I told him to bring him as a korban, and you know what he did? He did it because he trusted me. V'lo hir Avram midosai. He did not second guess or my motives, but you did. Moshe was punished here. Lefichach. Atotire, ato with an ayin, that is to say. Now you will see, and the emphasis on now, but not later. Ha'asoy leparo tire, you'll see what will happen to Paro. V'lo ha'asoy lemalchis shivas umos, but not what will happen to those seven nations, kishe aviyem la'aros, when I bring them to the land of Israel. Here, Moshe is being told by Hashem that he will not witness what happens when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel. And we have to assume that if Rashi picked up on this inference, that Moshe picked up on it. It's for Moshe first and foremost. Rashi informs us about it. And now the question is, if Moshe has already been told that he will not be entering the land, and it's really traced back to a much earlier episode of complaining towards the end, even again, we say 100 times, with the purest of motivations, but on Moshe's level, it was considered it's an indictment. So he already knows that he's not coming in. So why does he say no samanachnu? Why does he say we're all going in? He already knows he's not going in. And the truth is, the matter precedes even Perek Vav of Shemos. Because in Perek Dalet of Shemos, when Moshe is Perek Dalet of Shemos, Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud Gimel, when it's at the burning bush, and Moshe is debating and holding out, Hashem wants to send him, he doesn't want to go. And at a certain point, Pasuk Yud Gimel of Perek Dalet, Vayomer, Moshe says, Be Hashem, please Hashem, Shlach na biyad tishlach, send someone else. In his words, send with the one with whom you will send. What does that mean? And Rashi gives two perushim, but the second is, She'ein sofi lachnisam la'aretz. I know, says Moshe, in the end, I'm not going to bring them into the land. I'm not going to be there in the future, bring them in. So you have many emissaries. So why not already send now with the one who's going to bring them in? So these are Moshe's own words, or the inner content of that part of Moshe's words to Hashem. And he himself is expressing the idea he's not going in. So now we have in Shmos Perek Vav, he's told he's not going in. Even before that, he himself says he's not going in. And now come back to Bamidbar Perek Yud, and he says to Yisro, Nosim, Anachnu, we're all going in. It's not so simple anymore. It's become a Rashi situation. And I would like to present two classic explanations of Rashi's position here. From the two foremost commentators of Rashi, Rav Eliyahu Mizrachi and the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh. Al Rishon Rishon. The Mizrachi takes perhaps the best way to express the difference between Mizrachi's approach and the Maharal's approach is that the Mizrachi's approach quantifies the matter of these Rashis, whereas the Maharal's approach quantifies the energy within these Rashis, and we'll explain what that means. Mizrachi takes each of those earlier cases and explains how that's not a contradiction to Moshe saying we're all going in. Because, for example, if we take Pasuk Vav, Perek Vav, where Hashem says you will see what will happen to them, Atatira with an ayin, you'll see what happens to Par, but you won't see what happens to those other kings in Canaan. That doesn't mean that Moshe's not going in. It just means that he will not live to witness the conquest of Eretz Canaan. It doesn't mean he won't be entering Eretz Canaan. In other words, the Mizrachi, based on that earlier Rashi, pulls the expected time back from Moshe. Not that he won't be able to enter, but just that he won't be there alive long enough to see the conquest. But he's still going in. It's still Nosim Anachnu. That's Mizrachi's approach to that Rashi. And what about the Rashi where Moshe says that he's not going to bring them in to the land at all? Sounds like not at all, even to enter. Says the Mizrachi, Moshe never said that he will not enter the land. All he said is he's not going to bring them in. But that doesn't preclude the idea that someone else could bring them in, but Moshe can come in with them. So if we could summarize, really, the Mizrachi's approach, he's made shalom between all the Rashis in the sense that all Moshe needs to be able to say for Nosim Anachnu is that he'll be going into the land of Canaan. The earlier Rashis say he might not live there for that long, and also he won't be the leader bringing the people in, but as a private citizen for a certain amount of time, that niche is carved out of time and options. And that's why Moshe says Nosim Anachnu. That's matter being shaped here by the Mizrachi. But the Gur Aryeh takes a completely different approach. And Gur Aryeh says that even if it's all about the same thing, there's only one idea. It's about Moshe bringing the people in. And Moshe has already himself said that he's not bringing them in. And he's already been told that he's not going to bring them in. But still he says Nosim Anachnu. As Rashi said, because the decree had not been enacted yet, had not been stated to him. Says Maharal, how do these two things work together? It's very straightforward, says Maharal. Moshe already has an awareness that he will not be the one to bring them in. But awareness of such a notion and the irrevocability of that idea are not the same thing. The idea that something is pending, that something is likely to happen, or more correctly, that something stands to happen, namely that Moshe will not be able to bring them in, that may be. But that as a pending reality, as a standing reality, it can be overcome. Have we never met before the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can say something negative will happen and people respond accordingly and get themselves together and do tshuva and rescind that idea? And therefore, says the Maharal, Moshe is well aware that at things as they stand, he's not going to be going into the land. But he's confident that he will be able to overturn that. He's hopeful that as much as that is seemingly what the way things will be, but he can deal with that and overcome it. The only time things change, and therefore, you see, for example, Moshe's own words. There's his understanding of the situation. It doesn't mean it's final. And moreover, says Maharal, what about that final pasuk in Shemos? What's amazing about that pasuk is Hashem never says, you will not go into the land. It comes from an inference. It is not explicit. It is implicit. Now you will see, and the implication is clear, but there's a very big difference between a clear implication and an explication. And those are two completely different things. As if to say, the force through which, or the extent to which it is not fully explicit in Hashem's word, is the extent to which it is not yet a concretized reality that cannot be reversed. So one could almost say that an implication is to grammar what a standing reality is to final reality. In the same way that it is not spelled out in the pasuk, it's not finalized. Moshe can still say, no simanachno. The only time beyond which Moshe would never say we're all going in is when Hashem says, black on white, you are not going in. And that is something which did not happen until the episode with the rock. Lachein lo tavir es ha'am hazeh. And at that point it was final. Moshe still davened, but he would never say at that stage, no simanachnu. There's no confidence that it can be overdone. He tried his best and it didn't work. And this, therefore, is the approach of the Maharal. All of these three Rashis, they're about the same thing, but it is an ascending realization of reality that as being assembled as the psukim go on. And at a certain point, Moshe can yet say no samanachdo. Beyond that point, even Moshe would not say that we're all going in. So that's a very important, as we can appreciate, for its implications. Many areas of Torah, the nuance, is something explicitly stated? Is it inferred? Is it implied? Sometimes they can represent different levels of concretization of the reality of the situation that is being forecast. I'd like just to conclude by referring to the end of the parsha, Perek Yud Beis, which is the episode with Miriam. And Pasuk Yud, I was actually quite taken aback a few days ago, because I came across a comment of Meshech Chochma. Not only is his comment a big chiddush, but his observation in the pasuk is one that one could read the psukim year in, year out, and never notice. But once he's mentioned it, of course, you can't ignore it. That's how it goes. In pasuk Yud Beis, Aaron and Miriam, they spoke about Moshe, they spoke Lashon Hara, whatever the situation was, and they were dealt with quite harshly. Miriam gets taras in pasuk Yud, ve'anan sar me'al ha'oel. The cloud of Hashem's glory moved from on the tent. Miriam, she's leprous like snow. Even Aaron on Miriam, Aaron looks at her, she's mitzaras. And how easy it is to read this pasuk and never realize that the final few words are basically a repetition of the first half of the pasuk. The first half of the pasuk says, she's mitzaras. And then it says, Aaron turned to her, and she's mitzaras. Yes, because she got tzaras. What then is added by the seeming repetition of these final six words, by Yifed, Aaron, or Miriam, be named tzaras? If I read the pasuk so far, I know. Says Meshech Chochman. It's probably a trademark of the Meshech Chochman that you can never know what he's going to say. But it's interesting, actually, that the pasuk says, begins by saying she's mitzaras kashelek, kashelek, leprous like snow. It then says that Aaron turned to her and she was leprous. And now the question is, like snow or not? If yes, why doesn't it mention it? And if not, what happened? Did something change? Says Meshech Chochman, nothing changed. But there's still something happened here in these final words of the pasuk. How so? Tzaras kasheleg, leprosy like snow, is the brightest form of tzaras. That's that very glaring white. And it's actually the most severe form of tzaras. Says Meshech Chochman, you know, there is a Masechta Mishnayos which deals with tzaras. It's called Negoim. We rarely venture into it. But in the beginning of Perek Beis of Maseches Negoim, it mentions a fascinating fact, namely that when viewing the tzaras, sometimes the coloration of the tzaras will appear different depending on the color of the skin itself, because it's set against the background of the skin, which means if someone has very fair skin, then what for someone else would appear much a brighter spot, or brighter patch, but for the person whose skin is itself very white, so it doesn't appear that bright anymore. And the Kohen needs to know for all of the attendant halachas. In the words of the Mishnah, Baheres Aza, even a bright white patch of Taras, near Ace Bagermani Keha, says the Mishnah, but if the person is German, so then it doesn't look that bright. Why? Because all the Germans in the time of the Mishnah were of extremely fair complexion, and therefore, because the skin is so fair, so the white, if someone with relatively darker skin, you'd see the full brightness, but you don't see it. It's all context. And it then goes on to say, and if the person has very dark skin, so even a relatively darker type of white seems much brighter. And that's just forewarning the Kohen to look out for that, for whatever the implications are. So, says Meshech Chochma, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Sota, describing Miriam's complexion, and states that it was kashemesh batzaharayim, that her complexion was luminous white. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, what the pasuk is telling us is that in reality, her tzaras was the brightest form of tzaras, mitzaras kashelek. But then it says something else. Aaron turned to her. And when he did, she's mitzaras and not kashelek. Did the color change? No. But because her complexion was so fair and so white and luminous, so whereas the Torah gives us the objective coloration of white like snow, but it then further informs us that from what Aaron could see, it didn't look like white like snow. Because Miriam herself was white like snow. I mean, not to that degree, but to the extent that it didn't look like as bright, and therefore it looked like mitzaras, not kashelek. It's a very, very interesting comment, not only in terms of the parshanut, but it also underscores an idea which many mafarshim adopt, namely that when the Torah describes, or often when the Torah narrates a person seeing something and then describes what they saw, it describes it as they saw it, which does not necessarily reflect the objective reality. And that's a classic example here, because the Torah contrasts the two. First, the Torah itself tells you
what color it was. Mitzaras kashelek. And then it tells you when Aaron turned to her. How did it look to Aaron? No longer mitzaras kashelek, like the Mishnah in Megoyim. This is classic Meshechochma. All of Chazal ultimately will be found in the nuances of the Psukim. And this is certainly, again, in terms of Parshanut, it's a short comment, but it opens for us that whole idea of what happens when the Torah presents something and when the Torah describes a person seeing something. Sometimes the two are not always the same, and the Torah wants us to know both of them. There's as much to learn from the way the Torah describes the way people saw it because we're people, as there is from the way the Torah describes it itself. We'll leave it over there for this evening.